Hi, Chris.
Hey, Ryan. How you doing?
Not bad. This is a new experience.
It's very weird. We should stipulate for the audience watching at home, all three of them, my parents and yours, that we're not seeing each other. We're either looking at ourselves or we're looking into a camera.
Yeah.
And I also want to stipulate for the record that I'm being graciously hosted by the offices of the New America Foundation, and there's a bookcase behind me, which of course, Ryan, you can't see because, you know, you can't see me, but there's a bookcase behind me with no books on it.
Wow.
So I just want to, you know, for the record, say that my bookshelves at home have lots of books. And
well, you know, I've always thought of you as a Philistine.
Yeah.
You know, it's actually like Jared Leto in My So-Called Life, that moment when you revealed to me some weeks ago, and I hope this is not confidential, that you did not, in fact, know how to read, which, you know, definitely came as a real shock to me. And then, you know, we had a tearful moment where I explained to you that my love for you is transcendent and that I would, in fact, teach you how.
Well, luckily I can talk, which is why I'm walking in.
Yeah, I actually have a bookcase behind me as well. Now, I haven't actually thumbed through or read any of these books, or any books, for that matter. I consider book Larnin, as I call it, overrated. So, yeah, but no, we're both in libraries, I guess.
Yeah, so should we start, you know, talking about all the very exciting, I would say very exciting, actually. I can sometimes be a little bit of a cynic about presidential campaigns, and I think I was hating for a while, I would say, but I'm kind of into it now. Maybe that's because I've been devoting the entirety of my waking hours to it, so I can't, you know, do it. But should we move to a discussion of the very exciting presidential race? And
absolutely. That sounds like great fun.
Give the people what they want. Okay, so I think, you know, one of the interesting things we've seen this week, and it's on, you know, from my perspective in the progressive center-left, less center and more left in my particular case, but from the center-left progressive democratic perspective, is a really interesting kind of anti-Clinton backlash. You really saw it start in South Carolina, a lot of it jumping off of the antics of Bill Clinton, comments that were made that I think a lot of people thought were sort of out of bounds, racially tinged in an ugly, ugly way. The comparison that he made, that when asked about Obama's victory in South Carolina, he said, well, Jesse Jackson won in 1984 and 1988, which a lot of people found gross and dismissive and
right.
A little bit of race baiting. And just generally his, Bill Clinton's kind of, you know, weird status. I mean, someone's pointed out to me that if you go back to 2004, when he was campaigning on behalf of John Kerry, he was very decorous towards George W. Bush. I mean, incredibly, you know, I remember sitting at his convention speech, and he was talking about what a good guy George W. Bush was. He liked him personally, that he was honest intellectually, that he wasn't stupid. You know, all these sort of praises that said, you know, we just have a difference of opinion. It was almost like he was running against George W. Bush as if George W. Bush were a Democrat in the primary, and
right.
He's running against Barack Obama as if Barack Obama were a Republican opponent. And I think people have – there's been a real backlash against that, you know, among certain you know, what we might say, democratic elites.
Well, if you don't mind my interrupting,
yeah,
I mean, there
please,
is
no,
an
yeah,
obvious kind of psychological theory behind that, namely that Kerry's victory, how essential was this to any long-term Clinton project?
Right,
I mean, was
right,
this something
right,
that would have actually knocked Hillary Clinton's chances off course? I mean, that's an incredibly cynical reading, but in my limited experience, admittedly, the most cynical reading of the Clintons tends to be the one that's most resonant and the one that most lines up with the facts.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because I'm now – this is a funny phenomenon that's happened, which is – and Noam Schreiber wrote about this a little bit in the New Republic the other day, and I ran into Matt Continetti from the Weekly Standard at some event the other day, and I you know, it's this weird thing where the people on the left have been defending the Clintons so long, particularly because of the impeachment, because of what a lot of us view as really irrational hatred of the Clintons,
right,
and the kind of vast right-wing conspiracy attacks. Been defending the Clintons so long that we'd forgotten that actually when Bill Clinton was in power, particularly those on the left, the real, you know, the nation left of the party, we really felt betrayed and angry and frustrated at the Clintons. And the reappearance of Bill Clinton has brought a lot of that back. You know, a lot of the things that we didn't like about Bill Clinton when he was president. And I have to say, I actually like Bill Clinton a lot less than I actually like Hillary Clinton a lot more than I like Bill Clinton. I mean, at sort of just general level, you know, at this sort of superficial level of likability.
Yeah. Well, she does actually seem really appealing. I mean, whenever I read about her as a teen or when she was at Wellesley, she just sounds like a really cool lady.
Right, yes, exactly.
Who had a good head on her shoulders and actually sort of had a kind of daring sensibility. I mean, reading Saul Alinsky and sort of thinking, you know, kind of deeply and seriously about a lot of questions, having come from this very kind of bourgeois, upper middle class, suburban, Goldwater Girl background. So, I mean, I think that that's actually really appealing. And like, you know, David Brock and like a lot of people, I mean, I sort of have always been sympathetic to the narrative of Hillary Clinton having been corrupted by Bill Clinton. Now, obviously, you know, this is a very kind of crudely psychological picture, and there's a lot that's wrong with it. There's a lot that's misleading. Perhaps we're projecting to some degree.
That's right.
But I do think that, you know, and Matt Iglesias pointed this out to me yesterday. I thought it was a very astute point. The kind of skills that you need when you are a white Southern Democrat in the late 1970s, I mean, the kind of anger and vim that you need,
yes,
and the, you know, sort of the taste for hardball politics,
yes,
et cetera, it's something that actually, you know, perhaps it was necessary to get the Democrats to the point where they were in fighting trim in, you know, the late 80s, early 90s. But, I mean, now all of the things that made them successful now make them seem incredibly noxious. I mean, there's a way in which, you know, they could say that someone like a Senator Obama, who had been in the trenches but in his own quite different way, in a context that was monolithically left-wing,
right,
you know, didn't have to go through those,
yes,
wrenching,
yeah,
sort of experiences.
Right. And what you point out, it also points out that there's something substantive to it as well, which I think is, and this is something that I have a cover story that actually comes out right about now in the Nation this week, which is called The Choice, and it's essentially an extended argument for why progressives should support Obama over Clinton now that we're down to, on the Democratic side, we're really down to two people. And part of it has to do with what the legacy of this kind of inbred defensiveness that I think you're pointing to,
yeah,
which I think was obviously a Southern Democrat in the 1970s was incredibly necessary. And you know, the crucible through which the experiences of many of the Clinton circle, and this extends out past the actual Bill and Hillary themselves, the people who were you know, working in the White House and for the administration, was just this one series of crises after another where they were kind of always kind of in battle, from the Gingrich insurgency in 1994 all the way through the kind of Ken Starr,
yeah,
Inquisition and impeachment. And they have learned to be incredibly able survivors. But there's a fundamental kind of defensiveness in that from my perspective as a progressive who really thinks that we're at a moment because of public opinion data and because of the collapse of the Bush vision.
When Democrats should play to win.
Right, exactly, right.
Yeah.
We should play to win, and that there's a real opportunity to have a kind of, you know, people compare to the 1980 election. You know, obviously these historical parallels can get overblown, but there's something there about.
So how much of this is snobbery? I mean, to what extent do you think that the Clinton hatred that you see emerging on the left is just this distaste for this group of people to whom Democrats should be very grateful, in fact?
You know, the Shiver made that point. I mean, it's hard for me to say because I have zero connections with the people that would feel that way. You know what I mean? Like,
which way? The lack of gratitude?
I have no connections to the people that would, the people who would, whose anti-Clinton animus might be rooted in a kind of snobbery.
Hmm.
You see what I'm saying? I mean, the people that I know that I speak to, their anti-Clinton animus is rooted in NAFTA, the sanctions policy in Iraq, you know, the EDPA, which was the Enhanced Death Penalty Act or whatever, Defense of Marriage Act. I mean, the series of what were viewed by people on the left as sort of conservative betrayals of the progressive cause. So that's the people that I know who are feeling this anti-Clinton animus. It's partly stoked by the, you know, Bill Clinton's actual sort of performance recently, but a lot of it is dredging up these vestigial feelings of betrayal that were there, that are rooted in something substantive, I think.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to hear what you think about the snobbery point.
Well, I mean, I don't think that's it either. I can sort of imagine Clinton's, you know, the Clinton camp in their, like, endless embrace of, you know, victimhood and victimology, kind of seeing it through that lens. And there's a certain kind of coherence to that story, you know, namely that if you look at the kind of people who had been with the Clintons and then broke with the Clintons to join the Obama camp, you know, they tend to be a little bit more high-toned.
Mm-hmm,
they tend to be
mm-hmm.
a bit more intellectually inclined.
Mm-hmm.
And there is the sense among sort of Obama fans that the Clintonites are careerists, basically.
Right, yes.
That,
no,
you know,
that,
the only
that's
people
true.
Who, you know, are going to join that campaign are
yep.
people who are eager to get a job. So, I mean, I think that, you know, that, I mean, is that snobbery?
No,
not
I
sure.
think
there
that's
is a level of disdain.
Yeah, and we should be on, I mean, I should stipulate here because I don't want, you know, this will go on the internet. I don't want people to think I'm bearing an anti-Clinton torch. But, I mean,
yeah.
you know, there is a large degree of sort of self-righteousness that emanates both from Obama himself and the people around Obama that can be, you know, a bit precious. Josh Marshall had a line the other day on his blog about he gets emails from from Obama supporters who make it sound like Obama's this potted plant, you know. You can't put in, like, you know, it's just not fair to expose him to too much sunlight or, you know, harsh conditions. But, you know, and the fact of the matter is that this is it's American politics. I mean,
I think that, you know, the Clinton exhaustion, I think that you're absolutely right. A lot of it comes from the sense that Democrats need to kind of move beyond that era. They need to move beyond the kind of defensive crouch, et cetera. But I also think that, you know, there's a danger of, because in the context of a Democratic primary, the kind of language that people are very receptive to,
right.
I used to think, and it took a little while for me to be persuaded of this, but I used to think that someone like a Fred Thompson would actually be such a formidable Republican candidate. Obviously, that will never happen. You know, the stars weren't aligned for a lot of reasons. But, you know, you imagine someone like him, you know, kind of talking to a Hillary Clinton about a healthcare mandate.
Yeah, right.
And how devastating that argument would be. Whereas, I mean, if you think about someone like an Obama who had this instinctive distrust of a mandate, mm-hmm. Now, where did that instinctive distrust come from? Mm-hmm. You know, my sort of gut instinct, and this is what I've heard from a lot of Obama backers as well, is that it comes from, you know, having these kind of white Kansan grandparents. And, you know, kind of how are they going to react to this idea that people who are wealthy enough to afford to buy healthcare but choose for whatever reason not to get it are going to be obligated
sure,
to buy it?
Right.
I think that's so in that sense, I mean, it's weird. Because as far as how progressives, you know, self-styled progressives ought to feel about Obama, I mean, that's something that is, you know, quote, less progressive,
yes,
but also
no,
something that allows you to win the game.
Right. That's a great point. I mean, part of the reason, I mean, one of the points that I make in this piece is that, you know, I lived in Chicago for 6 years and covered politics there and covered Obama and covered the campaign and was very close with people in the campaign. And, you know, back in 2003 when he was gearing up for the primary run, which people thought, you know, he'd be lucky to come in third, you know, he was the rallying cry of Chicago progressivism, you know,
yeah.
young lefties in Chicago and liberals and so forth. And if you had asked me then, would you know, fast forward several years and progressives are in a presidential election and sort of split between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, which they seemingly have been, both according to my kind of anecdotal, you know, temperature taking and also some polling data. You know, I would have thought you were crazy because he was so firmly this progressive stalwart.
Yeah.
But I think that you're right that there's both a temperamental small C conservatism to him, and you know wherever that comes from, and also that he has been strategic in terms of, you know, shading himself, you know, in a more centrist direction since.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, my kind of read on the situation is that the Clintons actually have a decently coherent theory of change, so to speak, to use, you mm-hmm. know, kind of Mark Schmitt's formulation. But I think that, you know, when you look at the Obama campaign, it's so interesting you mentioned Chicago. And, you know, I always think about, you know, for example, there's not going to be an Obama-Giuliani race. It won't happen.
Right.
But about how interesting that would have been
yeah.
in the sense of, you know, two styles of urban politics.
Yes.
And this idea of, like,
right.
you know, kind of urban reform and what's the model. Because obviously, you know, kind of Obama comes out of these, you know, so many different weird political traditions on the left. One of them is this kind of Harold Washington sort of power to the people, you know, kind of very participatory kind of activist tradition, which I actually think is actually, you know, quite attractive and interesting
yes.
and actually sort of merits kind of greater attention in the context of left debate and also broader political debate. But also, you know, there's this way in which his presidential campaign, you know, part of its success is that it was grafted onto this Tom Daschle style,
yes.
dovish,
yes.
Midwestern, you know, kind of pro-industry, just this, like, you know, kind of very appealing, classically American sensibility that is definitely a leftish sensibility, but one that also is more culturally in tune
yes.
with, you know, kind of the heartland, so to speak.
No, that's I think that's a very apt, that's very well said.
So it's interesting, like, whereas if you look at, like, the Clinton machine, so it comes out of this, you know, kind of border state politics, this kind of very defensive politics, but also grafted onto that is this kind of the Democratic politics of celebrity and ultra wealth
mm-hmm.
and the kind of level of comfort with it. So, I mean, when you think about the kind of Democratic hatred of the Clintons, I mean, I think a lot of it is actually self-hatred.
Mm-hmm.
When you're thinking about the kind of upper middle class types who, you know, kind of bobos and what have
right,
you,
sure.
who, you know, kind of actually have gone on a very similar journey to the Clintons.
Yeah, no, I think, yeah.
Just, you know, the way that the Bill Clinton post-presidency as well, and the way that it's, you know, been so much like that of a Gerry Ford, just making vast, vast sums of money.
Right. And also,
better,
and
yeah.
also, this it's been a very his post presidency has been a very bobo enterprise. I mean, if you read Giving,
yeah.
you know, it's this very kind of like, you know, it's like politics reduced to like buying organic, you know, I mean, right? Like, and there's a certain sensibility to that, which is the kind of shrinking of politics,
yeah.
you know, or let me say this: the shrinking of non-state, you know, state guided politics, right?
Yeah,
it's more
billionaire
sort of,
politics.
Right, billionaire politics, yeah. Exactly. Consumerist politics and philanthropist politics. And that I think that's very true. There's a certain amount of... So yeah. you just mentioned a great sort of hypothetical that won't happen, which is the... which is an Obama Giuliani.
yeah.
So maybe we should talk about why that won't be.
I think Giuliani. I imagine our views on Giuliani are if not diametrically opposed, certainly really different.
Yes.
I think that kind of my experience of him and also my kind of hopes for the Giuliani campaign.
So we should note that we both grew up in New York City in the outer boroughs during the Giuliani years. So
yeah. I grew up in Brooklyn. I grew up in the fringes of kind of East Flatbush.
Right.
And you're from the Bronx.
Right, that's right.
And it was actually interesting because when he was running for mayor, I remember being incredibly, incredibly hostile to Rudy Giuliani. I remember thinking that this was, kind of this totally nightmarish figure, that he was basically a fascist. I mean, everything that I'd heard around me in school and from my folks, just this idea that David Dinkins was an ineffectual mayor, but he was a gentleman.
Right, yes.
And that he was being demonized and demagogued, and that Rudy Giuliani was essentially a thug. And it's actually really interesting because when you look at his 1989 campaign, Giuliani's campaign, that is, it was actually this, kind of really interesting kind of, early on at least, was this interesting fusionist effort where he was actually planning on running against Ed Koch, ergo he was planning on running to the left of Ed Koch. And, kind of his hero was Bobby Kennedy.
Right.
It was this very kind of civil liberties oriented, very kind of pro-poor, classic John Lindsay. I mean, he was going to do an end run around Koch's kind of conservative Democrat, kind of Queens, outer borough politics. And, so, then it actually ended up, he ended up having this radically different political personality kind of in the heat of battle. And it was a political personality that was incredibly distasteful to me as a 9-year-old. And then as a 13-year-old was also really distasteful to me. I think that, this happened for a lot of people. This sense later on that he was being unfairly demonized, the sense that he was on the side of kind of lower... and middle-class people in the outer boroughs, the sense that he had actually kind of tamed.
Right. Well, he was a classic kind of silent majority candidate, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and he was the New York, the New York Nixon in that respect. I mean, I don't mean that as, I mean...
Well, tell me about your take on him when you were a kid, because, I went to high school, I went to Stuyvesant, and I was riding the subway,
right.
And just literally riding the subway, when I was a kid, the idea of it was such an adventure.
Yes,
I remember,
right.
My dad taking me on the route that I was going to take, in the sense that, you need to be very cautious, and I remember being, a miniature 13-year-old with, my best friend and this kid next to a little bit younger than us, with a razor blade in his mouth threatening us.
Right.
I mean, it was
very
chilling.
And no,
I know
New
that
York
Hunter...
Was, I mean, in 1991, there were 2,000 murders or something like that. I mean, New York was a dangerous place, and it was something that I think, permeated one's experience of the city in every respect, particularly as a kind of young, vulnerable 11 or 12-year-old, riding the subway going down to... And
also as a white kid in the Bronx. Right,
yeah, although I should say, by the time the Giuliani years really got going, I had moved to this sort of enclave, this middle-class enclave in the Bronx called Riverdale, so it was sort of a different setting. But I was going down to Manhattan every day, and I was experiencing, we were getting jumped all the time. And, I mean, there was a sense in which... the city really did feel unsafe, and that, and I, crime politics are, they're the role that, and this I think maybe we could connect a little bit to what happened in the national campaign of Giuliani, or at least what the theory of the Giuliani campaign was going to be at the national level, is that, fear for your own personal security gets at a place in people's, concept of themselves, of their society, of their family, and of politics, that's a really obviously a potent place, right? And we've seen that time and time again from law and order campaigns, in the 70s, when people really felt like, to the Giuliani campaign, and then obviously, in a certain respect, the kind of post 9/11 terrorism politics. But that, it's easy on the left, that the way that fear emanates and the way that it can be brandished or utilized can seem scary or quasi-fascistic in all these ways. But which, I still feel that way strongly. But that said, you can't you can't deal with a populace that feels fear for their personal security by ignoring it, right?
Yeah.
Politically. I mean, that's one thing I think that people have learned is that, you know, you have to sort of address the fear head on. You have to lay out, and you can lay out, from my perspective, an alternative vision of how that fear is going to abate, how you're going to make people feel more secure, or why they shouldn't feel as scared as they do. But it's not something that can be ignored, you know.
Yeah.
And obviously there was always a connection between Giuliani, him kind of having tamed New York, quote unquote, and given people back a feeling of personal security as mayor, and him running for national office as America's mayor, and through the crucible of 9/11 as he emerged as hero, and you know, playing some sort of similar role in a post 9/11 America, right?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I wrote an article with my friend Ross a long time ago, you know, offering our own kind of theory of how a Giuliani campaign ought to work.
Right. That's
what
right.
It might look like. And, you know, I mean, this was kind of rooted in a lot of my kind of basic beliefs about him and about his flaws, but also about his strengths. And the idea was that, you know, in 1989, he ran this one way that actually didn't line up with, you know, a lot of his basic convictions, his core convictions. And then he ran in 1993 in a very different way, you know, armed with, you know, the Manhattan Institute's, you know, kind of panoply of ideas for urban reform, et cetera, and also like this, you know, kind of this, you know, fairly kind of well-evolved idea, whether or not it was right is an open question, about how to kind of fight urban crime.
Right.
And it was just this very kind of data-driven approach. He was incredibly relentless. He always was better briefed than his opponents.
Right.
But also there was this sense in which, you know, people were being told a series of things. You know, middle-class New Yorkers were told a series of things that, you know, if you fear crime, you're racist. You know, if you flee the city schools, you're racist, or you have some other kind of moral failing. And it was just, you know, wow. I mean, you know, the kind of level of outrage that kind of built up, and as you say, this kind of silent majority thing, he was actually telling people, you know, it's okay mm-hmm. to be angry. It's okay to actually expect more and better. It's okay to demand that we all be held to the same standard. These were these very resonant ideas, these ideas that actually could have linked up with a lot of domestic policy ideas that were a little bit more inventive and reform-oriented than what he ended up embracing. And I think that was really, really sad. And I think basically what happened, this is the read of, you know, certainly a lot of friends of mine and people who were around the campaign, is that Giuliani became a rich guy. You know, he just, you know, much like Bill Clinton became a rich guy. I mean, he just, you know, ended up spending a lot of time with other rich guys. Now, this doesn't mean that, I mean, his embrace of kind of free market policies was a mistake. I mean, you know, I believe in those policies, or a lot of them, I should say. But, I mean, just the whole affect of the campaign and the way that he was talking about, the way that he failed to talk about middle-class squeeze, the way that he, you know, so it was this idea of trying to project a kind of sunny Reaganite optimism,
yeah.
But he's not fundamentally an optimistic political personality.
Right,
that's
right.
Not what he
yes,
does best.
Exactly. He's much more Nixonian.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was, and actually, you know, kind of when we say Nixonian, it's interesting because actually that is the kind of hidden figure behind so much of 2008.
Yes.
If you think about, like, for example, yeah. Hillary Clinton, her stimulus package, or, you know, her approach to the subprime, you know, mortgage crisis, is literally Nixonian.
Right, yeah,
it's actually
right.
bringing back wage and price controls.
Right,
now,
right.
How serious is this? Does she actually believe this is going to work? You know, kind of we, you know, or at least I think I know what happens when you impose wage and price controls. And actually, her manner, the kind of way, the incredible opacity and secrecy surrounding her mm-hmm. campaign. So actually, I think there was a Nixonian candidate in the race. It's not obvious that Giuliani was the most Nixonian. But, I mean, your point is well taken. And actually, like, you know, I always thought of the McCain-Giuliani scenario, of Giuliani being the Spiro Agnew, the one who was able to kind of tell the uncomfortable truths,
right.
make unfair, you know, barbs and jabs. I mean, it's clearly kind of what he's best at, and trying to kind of take this kind of sunny, optimistic leadership role clearly didn't suit him at a basic level. So.
Well, and also part of the thing, I mean, part of the issue with the Giuliani campaign, I think, is, and this relates on both sides, the Republican and Democratic side, is that, you know, if you go back to, say, the polling in 2003 in
yeah.
the Democratic field, you know, Joseph Lieberman was way ahead in that.
Right,
era.
Absolutely.
I mean, the you know, so much of
name ID,
and
yeah.
you know, for people, I think for people that spend a lot of time, you know, anyone who's watching Blogging Heads, for instance, I think we can safely assume is a political junkie.
Yeah,
and if you're a political junkie, the notion that there's this that name ID is an important thing is sort of a little hard to get your head around, because obviously you've heard of all these people, you know.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, you know, it's incredibly important. A lot of people just haven't heard of the options on the table, and or are completely unfamiliar, or they've heard about it in passing. They don't have any sort of fixed sense of people. So, you know, the what's kind of projected before a campaign really starts, and Giuliani was dominating the national numbers for a long time,
yeah.
is really this, it's kind of built out of air. I mean, there's no, you know, there's no there there. I mean, we
yeah.
saw that, and in Giuliani's case, I think what happened was that he does not, and this is, you know, this is a superficial but important point, is that he's not a deeply likable personality. In a campaign context.
Yeah.
You know, I mean...
It's interesting you say that. I remember everyone, you know, a few months back, everyone was playing the ferret video where he was yelling at the man
right.
with the ferrets for being, you know, kind of mentally deranged. And I remember thinking, and this is why I'm, you know, profoundly out of step with the world, just thinking, wow. I mean, that man clearly was mentally deranged, and Giuliani told it like it was. And there was another incident with, you know, kind of, good grief, you know, the notorious radio incident where he told off
sure.
the mother of a guy who had been killed. And again, my reaction to that was, you know, wow, someone actually had the guts to
right.
say. Now, at the same time, we now have learned about his incredible petty vindictiveness,
right.
the way that he kind of was, you know, sort of bullying sort of various, you know, kind of minor small fries who had kind of crossed him in some way. And I actually think that, you know, the amount of skullduggery and sort of other kind of dubious stuff that we would have found out had we been in a kind of long-running, kind of sustained campaign. It's also amazing the kind of claims that he was making about his Republican opponents on taxes. I
right.
mean, you know, this was a situation where he was kind of rattling a tin cup, going to Albany or Washington, D.C. whenever there was a shortfall.
Right, yeah.
And
right.
demanding more aid. I mean,
right.
the idea that no one actually used that against him,
right.
I guess they felt that it wasn't necessary, but many, many massive vulnerabilities, a lot of which are just a function of having been a big city mayor. I still do think there was a story he could have told. There was a way that he could have won. And there were a lot of different kind of tactical strategic choices. And I actually think that this, you know, kind of imaginary Giuliani, who exists only between my ears, would have made a really, could have made a really compelling case against, you know, the likely Democrats. But his personality flaws, his desire to be fabulously rich,
right.
And his laziness, you know, much like Thompson, ultimately did him in.
Right. Well, so that leaves, you know, that leaves us with the other. The other side of the aisle with another casualty of the race, which is John Edwards, who announced this week that he's dropping out, which I think was a surprise. It was certainly a surprise to me, surprised people I know, and there's some sort of speculation about why he timed it.
You followed the Edwards campaign. For
yeah, I spent some time in the Edwards campaign. I spent 30 some plus hours straight on a bus ride in New Hampshire, and know some people close to the campaign. You know, Edwards has been. It's interesting, you know, people talk about what went wrong. I mean, we might say, you know, the same thing with Giuliani. I mean, what went wrong with that campaign? I think there's a few things. One is that he just happened to be running in a year in which this, you know, you had a candidate named Hillary Clinton who has a larger incumbency advantage
yeah.
and sort of a built-in structural advantage that's greater than possibly anyone who's ever run for presidency before
yeah.
as the spouse of a two-term, very popular Democratic president. I mean, George W. Bush had access to sort of some similar structural
yeah.
advantages. But and then you have this true phenomenon in the history of American politics. And I don't think that's overstating it to say Barack Obama. So part of it was just the time, you know, he just happened to be running in a year in which there was not a lot of
yeah.
political oxygen for his campaign to breathe. And it's true that the, you know, and I say this selfishly as a reporter, that you can feel yourself being pulled towards writing about Clinton or Obama because there's this sort of narrative, depth there. I mean, there's, you know, there's so
yeah.
sort of so much, it's such good copy, you know, and I think that really hurt him. Plus, I think that the press corps did not like his message at all. I mean, I heard reporters say so, and it sort of set their teeth on edge. And I think that I liked his message a lot because I think he was talking about, in terms of the issues and both the substantive policy that he proposed was rigorous and smart and deep. And I thought that he was talking to, you know, what from my perspective are some really real issues. But I wrote about this, and I think that it wasn't – the message had a kind of – I described attending an Edwards event as a bit like going to a funeral for the American dream, and they were depressing, frankly. I mean, and the state of a lot of Americans' lives are depressing. So it's not to say that was unreflective of the reality, but as just at the superficial level of what makes for effective political rhetoric in a presidential campaign, I think the message never was you know, the necessary kind of hopefulness and optimism, and those are cliches, but they're cliches for a reason, was never present. And so when you stack up all those things, and then you look at his fundraising disadvantage because the money also went to those two big contenders, I don't think he really...
I think that I have a pretty different read. I mean, I think that, you know, all of my kind of smart lefty friends have kind of made pretty, you know, tightly paralleled arguments about Edwards, namely that he radically changed the shape of the race by virtue of advancing, you know, kind of forthrightly, you know, kind of left of center policies on a wide array of issues. And I think that you use the term rigorous, which strikes me as exactly right. I mean, he certainly costed things out. He talked openly about raising taxes.
Right.
I think that, you know, kind of he wasn't always entirely rigorous, but I think that,
right,
you know, he was sort of trying to address the scale of the problems as he imagined them.
That's
to
right.
be,
yes.
He was addressing,
right,
he was at least in the right ballpark in terms,
yes,
of scales of solutions. I think that he's going to be remembered as an incredibly important historical figure for a lot of reasons, strange as that sounds. One of them is that even when you look at him as a senator and people talk about how moderate or kind of, you know, sort of minor league a senator he was relative to the kind of, you know, proposals he was,
right,
rolling out in 2008, well, actually, the interesting thing about him is that he kind of was in this mold of kind of handsome DLC kind of centrist Democrat, but he actually voted like a Democrat from Illinois. I mean, he,
yeah,
voted much like any Northeastern Democrat because, you know, the South is a lot more like the rest of the country than it was, you know, even 20 years ago.
Right.
So I think that that actually was a really important shift, and that's something that Republicans need to pay close attention to. I also think that, you know, the rhetoric, you know, the populist rhetoric of the 2004 campaign, when the, you know, solutions that he was proposing were a lot more small bore, that rhetoric resonated most with upscale voters.
That's right.
And this time around, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of the voters who kind of backed Edwards were actually people who didn't seem to be responding to his message at all, so much as the fact that he was a white man.
Yes, right.
It was,
yes,
oftentimes, you know, actually, you know, older men who are hawkish.
Self-described conservatives in a lot of the exit polls.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know,
right,
it's really interesting the way that works and the way that,
yeah,
the media reception,
yes,
and these things operate at such radically,
yes,
different levels.
Yes,
I mean, I think,
absolutely,
that the thing that I was most impressed by was, you know, kind of his, the way that he talked about the war on terror, the way that he was actually saying a lot of, you know, actually quite kind of well thought out and quite sophisticated things about those issues. You know, I mean, sort of knowing that there was certainly a possibility that, you know, he'd become a lightning rod by virtue of saying these things. I think that, I mean, what I kind of find, you know, you were talking about how the media, you know, he puts their teeth on edge, et cetera. I think that this idea, this idea that's become very pervasive in Democratic politics of painting American workers as victims,
right,
I think that it really is in tune with the Gestalt in a lot of ways.
It is
certainly
in tune?
Yeah, I think,
yeah,
it is in tune. I think that it's in tune of a certain type of voter, and kind of when I think about the long durée and I think about this kind of golden age of, you know, New Deal domestic policy that, you know, kind of Edwards and other progressives, self-styled progressives, kind of harken back to, it's interesting because, I mean, that whole period was parasitic on this radically different culture.
That's
in,
right,
America, a culture, forget about strong families, although that was obviously a part of it, but it was actually this culture of self-abnegation, self-sacrifice, and self-reliance. And so when you layer on, you know, social democracy over a society like that, then the end result looks very different from layering on that type of social policy over a society that does not have those values.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that cultural capital was, you could say, consumed completely and utterly during that historical period.
Right.
So then you have a political figure like an Edwards who's like, I'm going to speak the language,
yeah,
of a Hubert Humphrey Democrat or an LBJ-style,
right,
Democrat. But then you're dealing with this radically different audience,
yeah,
an audience that actually is quite willing to think, well, I, you know, got this mortgage and it has inconvenienced me in various ways. Now I'm convinced that I was swindled.
Right.
Whereas, you know, I mean, obviously this is a kind of real deep disagreement between the two of us.
Right, right.
And I don't expect you to kind of accept this narrative. But from my perspective, I think that it's interesting, like, it's a potent message, and maybe Edwards wasn't the most potent messenger, but certainly Hillary Clinton, you know, the idea that I am this serious adult who is going to care for you, who is going to deliver you opportunities. I care about America so much and so deeply that I'm literally weeping,
right,
about the fact that you would go with someone like Obama,
right,
who,
right,
thinks that Reagan should not be executed.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, it's interesting, like, how kind of powerful that stuff is coming from, you know, a different mouthpiece. But I think that, yeah, Edwards, you know, he was this interesting, quirky, anachronistic historical figure who was kind of talking to this kind of very kind of... It's like, I think of it in the context of, like, Princess Diana,
right,
and, like, this outpouring of grief. But it's not an outpouring of grief for someone else. It's an outpouring of grief for yourself.
Right, although I will say, you know, yeah, we do disagree on this. And I think that one of the things that I think a more charitable understanding of that you know, as less as a sort of exercise in self-pity is an exercise in or reassertion of you know, essentially the primacy of politics or the role of the state in and the role of a democratic polity in essentially, you know, shaping the distributional picture of an economy. We can, yeah, you know, talk about this more, but I do think that, you know, the sense of powerlessness that people feel, and people feel powerless for a million different reasons. They feel powerless because of, you know, I think a lot of Christian conservatives feel powerless about the state of the culture, the kind of movies their kids watch,
yeah,
you know, what's on the internet, et cetera. People feel powerless about the fact that, you know, their jobs are going, quote, overseas, and they have a college degree and they're not seeing their wages rise. So there's a lot of things that create powerlessness, and I think that, or not create powerlessness, create a sense of powerlessness.
Yeah.
And you know, what I think we're seeing both in Clinton's rhetoric moving, I think, a step in the direction of Edwards, but also in Obama's rhetoric in a very different kind of way, is talking about empowerment, really. I mean, so
yeah,
the uncharitable reading, which I think you were sort of giving it before, which I you know, I don't think is, you know, I disagree with, but I don't think is not there to be found. The uncharitable reading is that there's a sort of soft paternalism here, right? Which is that, like, elect me, this is a sort of classic, elect me to take care of your problems.
I disagree with that slightly, because I actually do agree that Obama offers a kind of different picture of this, a picture that I actually think is at least coherent. I think that, I mean, there's a kind of variation on a theme, and I think that Edwards, his variation of the theme was, let's get angry,
uh-huh,
and, you know, you're right, yeah, let's seize control of our government. Our government is in the hands of corrupt self-dealers.
Right.
And actually, when you look at the people who are endorsing Hillary Clinton, you certainly get the sense that that is in fact true. But then if you look at Hillary Clinton, it is this kind of maternal sort of, you know, I'm right, going to care for you, and
right,
yes, you know, it's not so much angry as I am capable and experienced,
right,
and able,
right,
to solve,
right,
your problems.
Right.
Whereas I think the Obama theory is actually, you know, you do kind of need to take control of your own life.
Right.
And,
yeah,
you know, yeah, mediate through democratic politics, but the idea is that you need an active and engaged citizenry if you're,
yes,
going to actually,
yes,
you know, have some surveillance,
yes,
of the kind of corrupt self-dealers,
right,
in Washington,
right,
ergo the kind of bashing of
and
lobbyists and what have you. And I actually think that's actually something that actually does resonate with, you know, kind of like right-wing culture war stuff.
No, it
politics
does. And I think, you know, one of the most interesting things that Obama said in the whole campaign, I'm trying to remember which debate it was. I think it was probably the debate that took place in New Hampshire, and it, you know, there's a certain amount of sort of process, good government, goo-goo, Weintrachism to it. But he was talking about, someone was saying, I think it was Edwards was challenging him on this fundamental point about how you bring about change, and obviously the Edwards critique of Obama is that, which I heard him say probably 25 times over the course of 2 days, is you cannot nice these people to death, right? They
yeah.
will drive through you like a freight train. Obviously there's something to that, right? I mean, but... Or from my perspective, there's something to that. But so I think Edwards was challenging Obama on this, and Obama said something. I was like, I want to reinvolve the American populace in the process of self-government,
right?
Self-governance. It was a line very similar to that, and it struck me as, now this is my own kind of, you know, romantic small d democratic kind of civic religion impulse that,
yeah.
you know, that's very stirring to me. I mean, that the process of self-governance, which we rarely think of in those terms because things are so mediated by kind of elites and elite institutions, the process of self-governance is something that is a kind of fundamental issue here, is very central, I think, to the Obama message, and part of what I find, you know, I particularly find very, very appealing about it.
I think that's dead on, and actually I think that one reason why, I mean, I think I've always liked your writing, and I think one reason why we're friends is that, I mean, you know, just putting it bluntly, is that, I mean, I think that actually there are many shades of kind of leftish belief that just strike me as just wrong,
mm-hmm.
But I think that actually this idea of creating a more participatory economy, you know, it's just, I mean, do I disagree with it? Sure, I disagree with it in some important ways, but I think that it's interesting and actually lines up with, I think that my core concern is this idea of self-reliance and
yeah.
self-government and the idea of, you know, surrendering control over our own lives. And
right.
that, you know, kind of...
Right. That's interesting.
I don't necessarily think of it, you know, kind of in this kind of classical libertarian way, but rather just the sense, you know, this sense of powerlessness and hopelessness that you describe, I think it's real.
Uh-huh.
And I think a lot of it has to do, I mean, from my perspective, with surrendering people are actually surrendering control. And then what's happening is that, you know, when you're reduced to what, you know, Keith Joseph called a pocket money society, mm-hmm. a society where, you know, when all of the kind of big ticket decisions are made by other people, mm-hmm. and it's not even necessarily, you know, that the federal government that's making those decisions, it's a lot of different actors.
Sure, right, yeah, right, exactly.
And also, like, as, you know, kind of you live in a more complex society, sort of, you know, it becomes more difficult to kind of comprehend in these kind of classical ways. And so, you know... And so who do you lash out against? I mean, what do you do? And the Obama idea that's appealing is that, well, it's not really about lashing out, and it's also not really about villains,
right.
per se. I
that's
mean,
right.
sort of, you know, when you think about these lobbyists, I mean, it's not as though, you know, Obama is actually demonizing them in the way that, for example, John McCain demonizes them.
Right.
You know, he just sort of sees this as a kind of broken process.
That's right.
Now,
yeah.
Now, how to go about fixing that broken process, I mean, you know, where the rubber meets the road, I mean, this is a much thornier question. But, I mean, it is really interesting, and it's really incredibly interesting to me to see even people, you know, in my own life who are, and the way that consumption becomes such an incredibly important and indeed central part of your life. And, you know, literally the kind of decisions that you're making are important decisions and, you know, one shouldn't poo-poo them. But, I mean, just the sense of the kind of the realistic possibilities for the range of things that one can do with one's life.
Right.
Because of, you know, kind of concerns about debt, for example.
Yes,
and what
right.
have you. And it's actually, like, I think there's a laziness to it. I think that there's, you know, kind of, I think it actually a lot of it is surrendering control because, you know, you're caught in status traps
right.
or something
yes.
like that. So I think that, you know, kind of Obama is basically, you know, serving as a bomb for a lot of people who've allowed themselves to fall into these traps. And he kind of, you know, is speaking a language that, and they don't always understand why it's resonating with them.
Yes, right.
But
I
it
think
does
that's
resonate.
Right. I mean, I think that there's an interesting kind of, you know, I had this experience, and this is when I was watching his speech on in Iowa after he won
yeah.
Iowa, and I'll never this experience to me kind of sums up part of what I feel about some deep contradictory feelings I have about the Obama campaign, which is that I was sitting there and he was giving this speech, and he was talking about, you know, in these very kind of grandiose rhetoric about this is the time in history when we can finally say that, you know, we can do X, Y, or Z.
Yeah.
And when he was saying X, Y, and Z, the actual X, Y, and Z were, like, fairly small bore, you know, nothing nearly as bold as the diagnosis
yeah.
or as the kind of style of the rhetoric, right? There's sort of this mismatch. And what happened to me, there was a moment where I'm sitting there with my wife, Kate, and we were watching it, and I'm thinking in my head, the internal narrative is, those are like kind of small bore things. And I was kind of feeling very skeptical in my head. And I looked down at my forearm, which was resting across my knee, and I had complete goosebumps, right?
Well.
So it was like, it really was this amazing moment in which my body, right? There was like, in the sense of like viscera, there was a visceral reaction to the rhetoric, to the tenor of his voice, to the story he was telling, that was deeply embedded in a physical sense such that my internal logical narrative about the content of the speech was absolutely divorced, which was skeptical, was divorced from the physical, visceral reaction I was having to the speech, that I noticed it looking down at my arm and seeing the goosebumps crawling across my forearm. So, you know, there's something there that is, you know, is really deeply powerful. I mean, and that's, you know, you're seeing that. And part of it is that it's hard for people who don't feel that in the presence of his rhetoric, particularly, you know, on the left I'm speaking now, to understand, like, what is the deal there, right? Like, there's something alchemical about it. I mean, I can't quite...
Yeah, I mean, that's actually something that, I mean, I find really, really fascinating, because, I mean, and I actually think that this is when, I think that people's brains shut down at that point. And
yeah,
I think that
right.
that's certainly what a lot of my friends who backed Edwards over Obama, you know, a lot of whom actually had a lot of contempt for Obama,
yes,
frankly.
Right, yeah.
You know, it was the sense that, you know, kind of this is a way, you know, the kind of power of charisma to kind of
yeah.
melt our brains. And I always think about this in terms of another, you know, kind of area of disagreement that I have with you. You know, just when I think about corporations and corporate chieftains who are embracing, you know, kind of this or that regulation,
sure.
and you know it as well as anyone. I mean, they have their very good reasons for wanting to do this. But it's amazing to me when I see, you know, like on Engadget, I remember, you know, a blog that I read pretty often, quite popular, when they were talking about banning incandescent light bulbs and how this is great and
right.
we're finally doing this. And of course, you know, why do you think they're being banned?
Right, right.
I mean, there is a story. It's a classic industrial organization
yes.
strategy story about a fear of independent producers, a sense that it's actually too costly to keep producing these, given sort of like a broad regulatory shift internationally. And so despite the fact that people prefer that kind of light, which is actually a pretty big consideration, I mean, that's why we're seeing this get banned. And similarly, you know, Obama, so incredibly sophisticated at targeting people like us.
Yes.
You know, I think about, you know, my great obsession is the web and sort of all things
sure.
webby. And so, you know, kind of obviously I have a lot of friends who are great net neutrality enthusiasts. And, you know, kind of Obama has this incredibly detailed set of policies on net neutrality and related
right.
issues. But again, I mean, net neutrality is one of these brilliant marketing slogans by a large, powerful corporation. Now, granted, I mean, there are kind of all kinds of, like, sort of intellectual arguments we could have around it, but kind of at its core, that's what it's about. And so, you know, I mean, it's not as though the self-dealing has vanished. It's
that,
you know, kind of there's some self-dealing that's actually packaged in incredibly attractive ways.
Right.
And this is not to say that this is anything that sort of, you know, Obama self-consciously does, but it's just, you know, I was chatting recently with a bunch of, you know, Hill staffers, and the level of cynicism, it was this amazing, like, you know, a friend of mine characterized it as, like, the Soviet Union in 1980.
Right.
I mean, any belief in the system has actually completely gone away.
Yes, right.
So then it just becomes the sense of, like, okay, well, we have one band of parasites.
Yes.
You know, that's
right.
us sort of battling
no,
another one, and here's how we duke it
yes.
out.
Yes, and this is actually, this is a point that you once made to me that I've always sort of carried with me, which you said that, you know, that not all good things go together. I think this is the
yeah.
way you put it. And I think, it, you know, it's a really true point. It's something that, and you're right. I mean, with a lot of these, the way that you want to phrase the battle rhetorically, morally, and politically from the left perspective, you want to rephrase these battles as essentially, the, you know, the people versus the powerful.
Yeah.
You know, you essentially an energized polity of people who are, you know, poor or working class or marginalized or middle class and forgotten against these kind of entrenched issues. But so often, the actual battles are one set of entrenched interests versus another set of
yeah.
entrenched interests. Interest. And you see, and I know I had a friend, for instance, who worked in a southern state legislature, and he was, you know, he basically said, look, you know, and he was working for a pretty good, a very a progressive Democrat by southern standards, and he said basically what we do is, you know, if we want to say take on, you know, the coal industry on something, we just go and find, you know, an industry that has another set of interests.
Right.
we recruit them because otherwise, you know, we can't do it. We certainly, like,
you know, you line it up, you line yeah, it up, and then have them duke it out.
Right.
You
know? And he was saying this is someone who wasn't, you know, that was the means, right? I mean, the point is that, and this gets back to the sense of the system being broken, is that essentially, you know, these things are mediated by such kind of sets of entrenched interests that this state senator in a southern state couldn't just decide that he was going to crusade against coal and get anything done.
This is, I mean, this is though, like, you know, Edwards, I mean, one of his great contributions, you know, kind of from the leftish perspective, was his massive program to fight climate change.
Yes.
And it's interesting because when you think about the kind of correlation of forces on an issue like that, and this is an issue that's of great interest to me, but I've become increasingly persuaded, in part by my friend Jim Manzi,
yes.
you know, when you think about that kind of a program and the kind of side deals that you would need to make this happen,
right.
The kind of side deals would be such that, you know, for example, let's say you have a carbon tax.
Uh-huh.
You would need to kind of bargain away the carbon tax by having some abatement for people in Wyoming,
mm-hmm.
You know, some sort of tax abatement. And then that tax abatement, of course, is not going to be quite enough to make up the difference, or there's going to be some sort of low-income protection built into it.
Sure.
And for a good reason. These
yeah.
are all basically decent ideas. And,
right.
you know, we have this tax cut that's larded with all these gimmicks because we're a democracy. That's not
right.
a bad thing.
Right.
But it also means, you know, these fantasies of, you know, I have the right ideas, I'm going to come in, I'm going to impose
right.
them,
yes.
this is my coherent idea, and
right.
we have this theory of change.
Yes.
We have, you know, Newt Gingrich had the exact same vision.
That's
in
right.
fact, he had actually a pretty sophisticated theory, namely, we're going to attack every single entrenched interest, so they're going to have to band together and sort of, you know, kind of like barnacles, encrust themselves to a kind of small handful of them.
Right.
And of course, it didn't work that way.
Right.
I mean, and
no,
so,
this is the,
you know, I do
yeah.
wonder.
And this is a good point, and this is something that I think actually this will be my counterintuitive point of the day, which I should have written up for Slate or something. But people talk about, I mean, the classic critique of campaign journalism is that we don't spend enough time on the issues. And the problem is that actually if you spend too much time on the issues, if you say you can get lost in this, this is something that I think Paul Krugman has fallen victim to a bit.
Right.
If you say, well, look, I'm gonna, yeah, let's look at these, for instance, the climate change policies as proposed by the three major, what were the three major Democratic frontrunners, you know, you can almost get to this point where it's like, you know, you begin to believe we're electing some kind of monarch, and on inauguration day, like, they print out their website and sign them into law, you know? I mean, that's,
yeah.
And it's just, in some senses, it's almost irrelevant, right? I mean, it's relevant as signaling, and it's relevant in terms of creating a mandate, and I sort of believe in that. I mean, it's much better to be elected by the American populace with you having proposed substantive agendas, right?
Yeah.
But when you start getting to these marginal comparisons, particularly within a primary in which the marginal differences are really not that big, and you don't have, I think, in the Democratic side, grand ideological clashes, you begin to fool yourself. You forget about the basics of transactional politics, which is what you're talking about, right? Which are, you know, so primary to actually getting things done, actually getting things passed. So yes, I think that, you know, you can. There's a danger to actually focusing campaign journalism too much on issues, because you could begin to fool yourself into believing that politics don't matter, and in fact, in any democracy functioning or non, politics are what matter.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting. I mean, just talking about Krugman, I mean we should chat about McCain briefly.
Yes, we should. Actually,
why don't we do that and then we'll come back? I mean, I think there's a lot to talk
right.
about.
So,
I mean, tell me, I mean, would you say that you think of McCain as a particularly dangerous and noxious figure?
I think you'll have to repeat that, because I just accidentally pulled out my earpiece.
Oh, yikes, I'm sorry about that. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
So do you think of McCain as a particularly dangerous and noxious figure?
Do I?
Yeah.
The former, not the latter. I don't find him noxious, but I find him dangerous. And the reason I find him dangerous is just because I think his foreign policy views are extreme and represent, and they're extreme, and they're extreme, but they're also, it's a combination of being extreme and smarter and more sophisticated than what we've been experiencing for the last few years, which I think in some senses makes them more credible and more dangerous. So I find him a dangerous figure. I mean, when he said, you know, that we're going to be in Iraq for 100 years at a campaign stop in New Hampshire, I don't, you know.
Well, actually, I mean, he said we could be there
for
100 years, and sort of, you know, kind of in a context where no Americans are dying, we would be indifferent to that. I mean, the American public would be indifferent, which actually is a kind of interesting view. I think that it's something that is a lot less controversial than the kind of frontline version of it. But it was also like a telling moment when he had that little exchange in New Hampshire, because it was just, you know, a classic McCain screw you moment.
Right, yes, exactly.
Just, you know, kind of wanting to kind of go out of his way to tweak someone, which is a quality that I actually, as someone who is ambivalent about McCain, it's something that I really, really like. I actually read another kind of astute observation just about how, you know, if you think about McCain's economic sensibility, it's basically this, you know, I'm going to take your porridge, you know what I mean, away from you. I'm going to, you know, take your bowl of hot steaming porridge that you use to nourish yourself, and I'm going to take it from you, and this is why I'm a good and virtuous person. And, I mean, I actually think that's a really good attitude. I mean, in a way, I actually think that in terms of the substance of his kind of domestic policy proposals, I mean, there isn't much of any substance.
Right. He said in a meeting with the Wall Street Journal editorial board, you know, with Phil Graham, his chief economic advisor, sitting next to him, that I think he said something like, I really don't know anything about economics.
Well, you know, good for him for having said that. I mean, I think that the trouble is, you know, kind of looking through a world. I mean, you know, he clearly has this prism that he looks, you know, and it's the same prism that, you know, kind of informs his foreign policy beliefs about kind of the honor and dignity of the United States and sort of maintaining our commitments. And it's the same attitude that I think makes him incredibly hostile to, for example, pharmaceutical companies.
Right.
Whereas, you know, kind of in the case of pharmaceutical companies, I mean, basically we have this, like, completely broken regulatory system. I imagine you and I would disagree about how it's broken,
but
regardless, basically broken. So the idea of actual villainy, I mean, it's just, you know, no, there are like profit-making opportunities in these ways that actually prove incredibly counterproductive and bad, you know, potentially.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that it's interesting to me, and I kind of think, but at the same time, I mean, I've always been quite impressed by him. I mean, I'm actually really, really ambivalent. I can't think of the last time I wasn't ambivalent about kind of any kind of election. I think that one case is the Obama versus Clinton race, where, I mean, I think that there's a clear right answer. I think that even now, I mean, I think for a while I thought McCain was a clear right answer, because, again, I mean, you characterize McCain's foreign policy views as dangerous, and your point is well taken. I think from your perspective, that sounds about right. I tend to think that his foreign policy views are, like, badly misunderstood. Now, why I'd be able to kind of divine what they are better than anyone else, I mean, is, you know, kind of, you know, a mystery. But, I mean, I think that when he says, you know, I would listen to Bill Kristol and Robert Kagan, and I would also listen to, you know, these realists, I'd listen to Henry Kissinger, I'd listen to Brent Scowcroft, people say, okay, that's incoherent. Does he even know who these people are? I think that's not quite right. I mean, if you look at the Reagan administration where you had Dick Darman, and then you also had, you know, kind of a whole slew of true-believing conservatives,
sure.
You know, you have this kind of balance. And this idea that when you're actually governing, you know, you're drawing on this, you know, kind of, you know, array of expertise, and you have some basic ideological core. It certainly seems that with regard to foreign policy, McCain does have an ideological core, but I do wonder, and this is a kind of parlor game I've had with a lot of friends, would McCain have invaded Iraq?
Yeah.
Now, this sounds like a complete no-brainer. I mean, of course he would have. He declared himself, you know, favored regime change in 1998, but of course if you look at the list of people who favored regime change in 1998, it's really, really long.
Sure.
I wonder, what's your read on that? I mean, sort of
that's
in a good, kind of
that's an interesting world. Counterfactual. I mean, I guess my tendency is to say yes, but in order to answer that question, you need to have an understanding of the actual reality,
yeah.
And not the hypothetical one, in terms of how unique were the set of circumstances around specifically the Bush administration that
right.
led us into this war,
yeah.
And my grasp of that is muddled. You know, I mean, I think that part of it was the fact that you had a remarkably incurious and unknowledgeable president at the helm who was able to be manipulated by his advisors and unable to kind of do the kind of bringing differing viewpoints in together.
Yeah.
Part of me thinks that actually the post 9/11 atmosphere, the long drumbeat towards a confrontation with Saddam Hussein and the power that people who wanted that confrontation held in the Republican Party would have meant that any other Republican president would have been so swayed. So you know what I mean? I feel like I don't have. So if it's the latter, if the latter is true, then I think McCain would have, you know. But if it's much more a one-off example of the dangers of an underinformed weak president, let's say.
One of the op-eds that I kind of remember really vividly was a piece in the New York Times. It ran in August of 2001, I believe, and it was called Allies in America's National Interest, mm-hmm. and it was written by these two guys affiliated with Project for the New American Century, one of them Jeffrey Gitman, two guys who were kind of in the very broad McCainiac circle,
uh-huh.
and the basic argument was that, you know, President Bush, you know, on a variety of policies relating to climate change, missile defense, etc., had been very foolish in alienating American allies, particularly in Europe, and, you know, this was a mistake, etc., and, you know, kind of what he needed to do is what he needed to do, classic Republican line, it was what Reagan did, namely actually try to articulate a vision where it's not the United States wants to do this and that's that, but rather, you know, here's why this is good for the world.
Right, right.
You might not agree with us, but that's the way we're framing the case. So whether it's climate change, missile defense, etc. And it's, you know, it's amazing that happened, you know, in August. And I often think about, you know, kind of the contours of a McCain administration, the way that they would think about these issues, their kind of instinctive sense that alliances matter. I mean, you know, and again, I mean, sort of, I think that, you know, that's very kind of boilerplate. It's very kind of CW. I think there's something to it. I don't think it's entirely right, but I mean,
right. Well, I mean, in some senses, though, from my perspective, we're you know, the question is like, could it get any worse, right? I mean, there's a case to be made that from where I stand and a vision of a world that in which the U.S. has sort of definitively renounced imperial prerogative and
right.
and you know the glorious utopian era of global governance, global social democracy has been ushered in, etc. That there is a question of like. Yes, would McCain? I guess there's a question: would McCain be a marginal improvement on Bush? You know, again, from my perspective, as someone who's sort of ideologically opposed, I think.
Right. No. That's totally fair enough. Yeah, I mean, sort of, you know, just even sort of the mere idea. Yeah, it's interesting because
just
clearly, like McCain.
I mean, what you seem to be saying, which I think I guess I'm not disinclined to believe, is that like at a basic kind of competence level, and also just in terms of a worldview that is less sort of instinctually knee-jerk hostile to internationalism. And,
yeah, I mean, I think that basically McCain is a firm believer in Pax Americana.
Right,
he's a
yeah,
firm
right,
believer
right,
in this idea right. of security as oxygen.
Right, right.
Once it's vanished, it's the only thing you think about, notice,
right.
or care about.
Right, right.
And I think that one thing that I find kind of most interesting as someone who is a kind of really, you know, staunch critic of the Bush administration is, you know, kind of the tremendous success of American diplomacy in East Asia.
Huh.
And sort of the kind of counterintuitive success. I mean, if you look at, you know, kind of where we stand now versus where we stood at the beginning of the Bush administration, it seems that you could make a decent case as victory Dr. Cha made the case that we've actually seen nothing but actually pretty significant improvements, and that, you know, kind of the erosion, the alleged erosion in American influence is in part a pretty natural response to the fact that, you know, kind of our share of the global economy is never again going to be what it was
That's
in 1945.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right.
And this idea of a kind of natural glide path, the idea that, you know, kind of we historically were this kind of commercial republic, not a hegemon, and the idea of a kind of presidency that would kind of be, you know, kind of more deft and sophisticated about thinking about this kind of new international environment. You know, McCain is so clearly a product of this older generation, which is, you know, kind of a great part of his appeal.
Right, no, that's clearly.
And the way that he thinks about the world. But, I mean, sort of more to kind of the domestic issues.
Right, because the political valence of that is interesting, because I think that, you know, we're seeing one of the things that I think is hurt Obama for a little bit.
Yeah.
Is that his biggest distinctions with his rival are on foreign policy, where she's played hawk to his dove routinely.
Yeah.
And the diminished coverage of Iraq and salience of it in you know, relative to the economy and the looming recession and subprime crisis, etc., you know, has hurt him, I think. And on the Republican side, I'm curious what you think of, just from the kind of political perspective. I mean, the fact that Romney won Michigan, obviously he was a favorite son there, but you know, he seemed to be able to more effectively articulate a kind of economic message. How capable McCain of that? How capable McCain is? I can't even get that out.
I think that it's going to be. I mean, I basically think that it'll be a very interesting election in which McCain will not discuss economic issues at very great length, in part because I think that, you know, if you have Hillary Clinton and if you have a centrist Democrat, you know, McCain's kind of basic gut instincts, how far are they from a kind of centrist Democrat? I mean, they're far on some issues, I mean, sort of in terms of kind of who do you trust.
Sure.
But, I mean, I think that he has this really profound distrust of entrepreneurs.
Yes.
I mean, I think that, you know, kind of distrust is strong, but I think that he doesn't have the kind of requisite respect for them that you'd expect from,
right,
you know, kind of someone who is an heir to kind of the Reagan coalition.
Right. And that's because he's grown up, you know, his entire life has been within the machinery of the state.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and, you know, kind of the military, you know,
right,
sort of, it's interesting because, you know, it is this obviously sort of, you know, kind of broadly conservative culture,
right,
but it's also, I mean, is it hostile to profit? I mean, I wouldn't say that, but I mean, certainly it's not something that rewards kind of entrepreneurship.
Right.
Even, you know, kind of when you see sort of the attitude toward kind of showboating generals, that kind of thing. I mean, you know, it's interesting.
Right, that's right. And even we saw in the debate the other night, right? Where didn't he rib, you know, Romney by saying that, you know, McCain's life had been dominated by patriotism, not profit, or something like that.
Right, and of course, you know, McCain is a wealthy man because he married well.
Right.
And, you know, the idea that, it's interesting, and it does sadden me a little bit, and I think that, you know, I actually think that's a set of issues where I would really love to see an effective Republican message to counter, you know, the kind of the shared kind of left populism that you
yes.
see emerging on the Democratic side.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure we're actually going to have that. I think that I can actually very easily see McCain running on a war platform and sort of running
right.
on this basic premise that Americans don't want to lose a war.
And because you're too polite to do so, I should note that you have written on this topic in an essay called The Party of Sam's Club, or right? Is that was that?
Yeah, I mean it's interesting.
And you have a book coming out, I should also note, which you won't.
I'm sort of, I hope people will
read it. You're
too
polite to say,
like,
but there's a grand new party which will be out this spring.
I think that when you think about when you think about sort of like, yeah, what a McCain economic message would look like, it's interesting because, like, staffers on the Hill, they have no idea.
Right.
It's completely like an alien sort of, like, descending
yeah.
on the planet and, like, what he's going to say or what he's going to care about. I mean, they sort of, you know, kind of have this sense, and it's right, that, I mean, you know, he'd probably throw them under the bus on issues like, you know, kind of a top marginal tax rate, stuff like that. I mean,
right.
these are not things that he kind of cares about
right.
all that deeply.
Yeah, right.
So it's the whole issue is, I mean, I think a lot of, you know, who is he going to appoint? I mean, who's he going to listen to? Who's, you know, he's presumably going to outsource, you know, kind of a lot of domestic policy making to other people, and the question is, who is he going to choose? Now, the fact that he has such warm feelings towards Mike Huckabee, some of this could be, again, his contrarianism. Some of this could be a sense that, you know, kind of he actually has crafted a kind of, you know, decently resonant message. And I think a lot about Mike Huckabee and kind of his potential and his limitations.
Right.
So, I mean, we just have, like, very kind of crude, very kind of minor indications, nothing terribly conclusive. One thing I want to briefly mention, a little randomly, is that there's this really brilliant comic book called Shooting War.
Okay.
That was this kind of left-wing comic book that takes place, I believe, in the year 2011. And the premise is that it takes place in Iraq. It's a young left-wing blogger who's, like, now the only embedded reporter left in Iraq. And it's a President McCain.
Huh.
And now the United States has aligned itself with so-called secular nationalists opposing religious extremists.
Huh.
And these secular nationalists are, of course, former Baathists. It's this, like, really, like, amazing, bizarro world that seems incredibly plausible and increasingly plausible. So, I mean, I really urge anyone to read it. It's called Shooting
Depressingly Bird. Plausible.
And it's actually, a lot of it's available on the web, so you can check it out.
All right, well, that's a good plug. So, maybe we should end on the Shooting War plug.
Okay, sounds good to me. It was really great chatting
this
with you.
This was great. We should do this again next time. I'll make sure that I bring lots of books to put.